his beautiful face. The SS men pulled us past the crowd, and the people in line stared and whispered to one another. I turned and saw the SS man who had followed me, close behind, holding Susanna and Luisa, each by one arm. Matka broke through the ticket line and ran after us. The look on her face scared me as much as anything. I'd only seen that look once before, on the wild-eyed face of a horse hit by a carriage and dying in the street. She clutched the little basket with my sandwich in it close to her chest. "Go home, Matka," I called. "No, please, you had the wrong people," she said to the guards. "Criminelle," one woman in line said. "They've done nothing," Matka said, appealing to the crowd, her wild horse eyes wide. "This is my daughter. I am a nurse at the clinic." She went on like that, then came running after us, begging the men to release us until one of them said, "If she wants to come so badly, let her join them," and grabbed Matka as well. He snatched her basket and threw it to one of the German women waiting in the ticket line. "But who will sell us tickets?" a Fraulein in line asked the officers. "Who needs tickets?" he said. "Just go in. It's free tonight." The Germans hesitated, confused, and stood where they were as the SS dragged us off into the dark, the trumpets of the horse vessel song blaring into the night air. They separated men from women at Lublin Castle, and the next day trucked a load of us to the rail station. Many around us shoved letters and bribes at the guards. Matka handed a letter to one of them. "Please, I am German. Can you get this to Oberscharführer Lennart Fleischer?" She handed the man some money, and he stuffed both that and the letter in his pocket without even looking at them. They had no time for such things and simply pushed us along. Fleischer was Lennart the Brave's last name? It means butcher. This was fitting. They shoved Matka, Susanna, Luisa and me, and at least 100 other women into what was once the dining car of a train, now with all the tables removed, and locked the door. Metal bars stood affixed to the windows, and a tin bucket for our sanitary needs sat in the corner. I recognized a few girls from my old Girl Guide troop, including a dazed Janina Grabowski. Had the Gestapo come for her at Lipova Street? My heart sank when I saw Mrs. Mikelski was there too, baby daughter in her arms. They'd been arrested when the Gestapo caught Mr. Mikelski distributing underground newspapers. Their child was almost 2 years old by then, aptly named Jagoda, for she did look like a blonde little berry. After a few hours, we stopped in Warsaw, but soon started moving again and picked up speed. Not one of us in that car wept. We were mostly silent, the shame of it all so heavy to bear. I made my way to the window as night fell, and watched through the iron bars as we passed moonlit fields and dark forests. There was something disturbing about those trees, so close to one another. While Mrs. Mikelski slept, Luisa and I busied ourselves taking turns holding Jagoda. Small for her age, the baby wore only thin cotton pajamas, so we held her close. But even with that task to distract us, Luisa was soon in a state. "What will my mother do without me?" she said. "I always help her bake." "Don't worry. You'll be home before long. This is all temporary." "What about Pietrik?" Luisa said. "Is he on this train?" The car lurched right, and the excrement in our toilet bucket spilled over the top, onto two women sitting on the floor, causing them to cry out and jump up. "How should I know?" I said. "Keep your voice down. People are sleeping." "Will they let us write letters?" "Of course, Luisa. We will probably go to work somewhere, picking beets or something." "Would they lock us up?" Luisa asked. "I don't know, Lou. You'll see. It won't be so bad." Mrs. Mikelski came to take the baby, and the train rocked like a terrible cradle, lulling most of my fellow travelers to fitful sleep. Luisa rested against me near the window, while Matka slept with Susanna in a corner on the floor. The two looked beautiful lying there, Zuzanna resting her head on Matka's shoulder like a baby, her long legs curled up beneath her. Luisa traded places with Zuzanna and fell asleep at last, and as we sped toward Germany, my own demons crawled out to visit. How could I have gotten us all arrested? It was one thing to suffer myself on account of my own stupidity, and quite another to bring everyone I loved down with me. Why had I gone to the theater? My lack of thinking had ruined us all. Would there be a trial? They surely would release the others once they realized they'd done nothing. Only I would be detained. Had Pietrik already been shot? They did it in the castle courtyard, we all knew. I trembled all over. Where was Papa? We needed to get off that train right away if we were to have any hope at all. I reached up to the window and unlatched the sash. Though it was night, the shapes of spruce trees sped by. The air was growing colder as we went farther west. "It's time for you to rest," Zuzanna said. "We have to get out of here." "Get a hold of yourself, Kasia." "I can't stay here," I said, the anxiety mounting. "Why can't I breathe?" Something compressed my neck, squeezing. "Stop it," Zuzanna said. "You'll scare Luisa. She's already bad enough." I doubled over at the waist. "I'm dying." Zuzanna turned my wrist and fixed the pads of her fingers in a row along the inside of it. "Your pulse is elevated. You are having a panic episode. Breathe. Big breath in, deep breath out." I filled my lungs as best I could. "Look at me, Kasia. Breathe again. Don't stop. This may take 10 minutes to pass." Having a sister who knew everything about medicine came in handy. It took almost exactly 10 minutes for the episode to abate. Hours later, we passed through Poznań and then veered off northwest. The morning light showed the leaves on the trees, redder and more orange the farther we went. I dozed, cheek against the cool iron bars, and woke once the train slowed. Luisa and others came to stand next to me at the window. "What is happening?" she asked. The whistle screamed long and high as the train slid into a station. Matka pushed through the women and stood with me. "What do you see?" I held her hand. "Sign says Fürstenberg, Mecklenburg." There were women on the platform, blonde giantesses wearing hooded black capes over their gray uniforms. One threw a cigarette down and squashed it with her boot. A few held dark Alsatians at their sides. The dogs seemed to anticipate our arrival, watching the train cars go by much as a pet waits for its owner. Had they done this before? "Germany," a woman behind me said, craning her neck to see. Luisa cried out. The train whistle screamed a second time, and my breath again started coming hard. Matka held my hand tighter. "Must be a labor camp." "I can see a church steeple," I said. The thought of the Germans of that town sitting in church on Sundays with their hymnals was comforting. "God-fearing people," said someone. "Fürstenberg," said Mrs. Michalski. "I know it. This is a resort town." "As long as we work hard, we will be fine," Matka said. I curled my hands around the iron window bars to steady myself as the train lurched to a stop. "At least they know the commandments," I said. None of us knew how wrong we were that morning as we stepped out of that train and fell headlong into hell.
Chapter 12. Caroline, 1941. As spring approached, the situation in France grew more desperate. Every morning by 10, the consulate reception area was already jammed and my schedule full. The Nazis stomping all over Paris had thrown those French citizens stranded in New York into the depths of despair and often dire financial circumstances, something we were powerless to assuage. Under strict orders from Roger not to offer my own funds, I could provide chocolate bars and a shoulder to cry on, but little else. One morning, I set one of Betty's shoeboxes on my desk and began assembling an orphan package. There'd been no new word from Paul. I tried to stay occupied to stop the dark thoughts. Anything to tamp down the ache in my chest.
"You've got a full schedule,"
Pia said, as she dropped a pile of folders on my desk.
"First up, your high society friends who don't take no for an answer."
"That doesn't narrow it down, Pia."
"I don't know. Pris something and her mother."
It was Priscilla Huff, a leggy blonde who'd been a year behind me at Chapin. Flawless in a blue Memboche suit, she was uncharacteristically friendly. Electra Huff, an only slightly less trim version of her daughter, followed and shut the door behind her.
"What a chic little office you have here, Caroline, dear," Mrs. Huff said.
"I'd like to adopt a French child, Caroline," Priscilla said, as if ordering Chateaubriand at the Stork Club. "I'll even take twins."
"There's a waiting list for the few children waiting for adoption, Priscilla, but Pia can help you with the paperwork. You'll just need your husband's signature."
"How is Roger Fortier?" Mrs. Huff asked. "Such a lovely man, your boss."
"Well, that's the thing, Caroline," Priscilla said. "I'm not married."
"Yet," Mrs. Huff said, browsing the silver frames on the mantel. "There are two offers pending." I set a clean pair of oatmeal-colored socks into the shoebox. Two offers pending? What was she, a two-acre parcel in Palm Beach with privacy hedge?
"It takes two parents to adopt, Priscilla."
"Mother's French is excellent. I'm plus que fluent as well."
Priscilla had the French language requirement down. She'd beaten me in the French essay contest every year. The fact that their cook prepared an elaborate bouche de Noël for the class each Christmas didn't hurt, since our French teacher, Miss Ben-Goyen, the sole judge, had a well-known sweet tooth. Why did I want a cigarette so badly?
"I understand, Priscilla, but I don't make the rules. These children come from tragic circumstances, as you can imagine. Even two parents can have a difficult time."
"So you send packages to orphaned children but turn down a perfectly good home? I can offer a child the best of everything."
"Maybe, until the next bright, shiny object came along."
"I'm sorry, Priscilla, but I have several appointments this morning."
I walked to my file cabinet.
"Word is, you are adopting," Priscilla said.
"You hear many things these days," I said.
"Seems some can go around the regulations,"
Mrs. Huff said, adjusting one glove.
"I lost my father when I was 11 years old, Mrs. Huff. Growing up fatherless is a terrible thing. I wouldn't do that to a child."
"More terrible than no parents at all," Priscilla said.
I shut the file drawer.
"It is a moot point, I'm afraid. There just are not that many French children to adopt."
Priscilla pouted, and I stifled the urge to throttle her.
"I thought there were ships of orphans arriving daily," she said.
"No, very few, actually. After the city of Benares..."
"City of what?"
asked Priscilla.
Mrs. Huff reached for her bag.
"Well, if it's money you need. I heard you and your mother had to pull out of the Meadow Club."
I sat back down in my desk chair.
"We sold our Southampton house, Mrs. Huff, and we summer in Connecticut now, so we've no need for the club, and no, you can't just buy a child, Priscilla. If you read a newspaper now and then, you'd know the city of Benares was a British passenger ship carrying 100 English children sent by their parents to Canada to escape the London bombings, en route from Liverpool to Halifax, Nova Scotia."
Mrs. Huff placed two hands on my desk and leaned in. "We're interested in a French child, Caroline." 4 days into the journey, the children, ages 4 to 15, were in their pajamas, ready for bed. I felt the tears coming. Priscilla folded her arms across her chest. "What does this have to do with adopting a French..." "A German submarine sank the ship, Priscilla. 77 of the 100 children on board drowned. As a result, all child evacuation programs have been brought to an abrupt halt for now. So I'm terribly sorry that you ladies won't be buying a child today, and now I must ask you to leave immediately. I'm very busy at the moment, in case you didn't notice the packed reception area." Priscilla checked her stocking seams. "No need to get snippy, Caroline. We're only trying to help." Pia knocked, entered in the nick of time, and showed the Huffs out, just missing Roger, who came to stand in my doorway.
"You'll be happy to know I've granted you a higher security clearance, Caroline."
I opened my drawer and arranged a row of new Hershey's bars, hoping Roger wouldn't notice my shaking hands. "Whatever for?"
"We've known for a while there are transit camps all over the Free Zone. They've been herding in foreigners. Jews, mostly, but not exclusively. Now there are reports of transports out to camps in Poland and other places. I was wondering if you could take it on."
I swiveled to face Roger. "Take on what, exactly?"
"We need to figure out where they're going. Who? How many? What they've been arrested for. I'm tired of telling people I don't know what's happened to their families."
"Of course I'll do it, Roger." I would have access to classified information, a ringside seat to the events in Europe. No more having to wait for the New York Times to get the news. Maybe some new intelligence would surface about Paul.
"It's hard to ask this of you with no paycheck in return."
"Don't worry about it, Roger. Mother and I are fine." Truth was, Father had left us comfortable, but we still had to watch our pennies. We had a few income trickles and a few assets we could sell, and there was always the silver. When we closed for lunch that afternoon, I ran downstairs to the Librairie de France bookstore just off the Channel Gardens, borrowed every atlas they had, went back to my office, and lunged into a whole new world of classified information. British reconnaissance photos, confidential documents. Pia dumped files on my desk, and I lost myself in research about the camps. Transit camps in the Free Zone. Gourges, Le Vernet, Argel-sur-Mer, Agde, Des Milles. The surveillance photos were disturbing, detailed, and voyeuristic, like peering into someone's backyard. I organized the camps into folders and soon discovered a whole new classification in addition to transit camps. Concentration camps. I taped a map to my office wall and peppered it with pins as we were notified of new camps. Roger fed me the lists, and I kept track. Soon, Austria, Poland, and France were dotted with red pins, as if sick with scarlet fever. Months went by without another letter from Paul. With the Nazis running roughshod over France, it was hard not to imagine the worst. Roger passed on news from abroad. At first, the French had adopted a wait-and-see attitude about the Germans. As Nazi officers requisitioned the best restaurant tables, Parisians did their best to simply ignore them. Paris had been occupied before, after all. They seemed to be hoping it would all go away. Never particularly good at taking a hint, the Nazis started requisitioning the best charcuterie and wine for themselves, and announced their plan to relocate Paris's entire fashion industry to Hamburg. After all this, and once the Nazis started rounding up French citizens with no warning, We received reports that said small resistance groups had started to crystallize here and there in Paris and distribute anti-German leaflets, laying the groundwork for an effective intelligence network. Less than a week after we received these first reports, there was a sharp increase in reports of underground activity all over France. I had my orphan work to keep me busy, and Mother was a tireless partner for the cause. One evening, I pulled everything out of the guest room closets at the apartment, searching for garments we could dissect and transform into orphan clothes, while Mother stitched together the few decent pieces of material we had. The guest room was a curious combination of Mother and Father, for it had once been his study and retained a masculine air with its striped wallpaper and ebonized partner's desk, but had later become Mother's sewing room and bore the remnants of her projects. Tissue-thin amber dress patterns flung about, padded wolf dress forms of assorted sizes, unfortunately growing less wasp-waisted over the years. I hauled out Mother's rummage sale bags and our winter woolens, scrounging for soft scraps of material. I've never shown aptitude for sewing, and it's just as well since it's ruinous to good posture, but Mother was a brilliant seamstress. She sat at her sewing machine, head bent over the old black Singer, her hair white in the lamp's arc of light. Once Father died, her dun-colored hair had turned the color of Epsom salts almost overnight. She had cut it short, started wearing mostly riding clothes, and put her rouge away. She'd always loved her horses and was more comfortable with a curry comb than a silver one. But it was sad to see such a beautiful woman give up on herself. We listened to war news on the radio as we worked. April 19th, 1941. While Belfast, Northern Ireland, sweeps up after a heavy Luftwaffe raid, London has suffered one of the heaviest air raids of the war to date. As German troops advance into Greece, Greek Prime Minister Alexandros Korizis takes his own life, and the British evacuate Greece.
Oh, do turn it off, Caroline. There's so little hopeful news. At least we've stuck a toe in the war.
Though still officially a neutral nation, the United States had finally begun sea patrols in the North Atlantic.
To think of Hitler running about what's left of the Parthenon, Mother said. Where will it stop?
I slipped a seam ripper into the tin sand pail Mother used as a catch-all for bobbins and scissors and felt metal meet grit. There was still sand at the bottom of it, from the beach at Mother's family's Gin Lane cottage in Southampton. Such a lovely beach. I could see Mother and Father there. She in black bathing costume, he in suit and tie, wrestling with his newspaper in the wind, the salt air pricking at my lungs. At night, in the chiaroscuro of the vast living room, I would pretend to read, one cheek to the cool linen sofa, and watch them play gin rummy, laughing and drinking each other in.
Let's go out to Southampton, Mother. A change of pace will do us good.
We had sold the Gin Lane cottage by then, but Betty still kept a house there.
Oh, no. It's full of New Yorkers now.
You're a New Yorker, Mother.
Let's not bicker, dear.
She avoided the beach. It brought back memories of Father for her, too.
I suppose we can't leave now, anyway. The orphanages will be desperate for warm clothes once the weather turns colder.
You can still post your comfort boxes through the mail. The Germans encourage people to send help for the orphans, and even to those in transit camps. Keeps costs down for them.
How kind of the Boche.
Mother used the French word Boche, meaning square-headed, when referring to the Germans. Her small act of defiance. I turned to the bed and gathered an armful of Father's woolen jackets. She pulled the sleeve of one toward her. We can cut those down. We're not cutting up father's things, mother. And besides, we need fabrics that children can wear next to their skin.
I pulled the jackets away from her.
It has been over 20 years since he died, Caroline. Camel hair is moth candy. I've been having father's jackets cut down for myself, actually. Father's jackets fit me well after alterations. They were made with the best 2-ply cashmere, vicuña or herringbone, each leather button a work of art. The pockets were lined with satin so thick, putting a hand in one felt like dipping it in water. Plus, wearing father's jackets kept a piece of him near me. Sometimes, when I was standing on a street corner waiting for a light to change, I found crumbles of cigar tobacco in a deep crease or an old peppermint in cloudy cellophane in a hidden pocket.
You can't keep every old thing of his, Caroline.
It saves money, Mother.
We're not in the poorhouse yet. The way you talk, you'd have us all lashed together singing, "Nearer, my God, to thee." We always make do.
Maybe we should cut back on staff. After Father died, Mother collected mouths to feed the way some people collect spoons or Chinese export porcelain. It wasn't unusual to find some poor soul from a hobo den living in the guest room, propped up with a goose-down sham reading The Grapes of Wrath, cordial glass of sherry in hand.
It's not as if we keep liveried footmen, dear. If you're talking about Sergei, he's family. Plus, he's the best French chef in this city and doesn't drink like most.
And Mr. Gardiner? I said. That question needed no answer. Our gardener, oddly enough called Mr. Gardiner, was practically family as well. With his kind eyes and skin brown and smooth as a horse chestnut seed, he'd been by our side since we planted our garden up in Bethlehem just before Father died. It was rumored his people had come to Connecticut from North Carolina by way of the Underground Railroad through a stop once located in the old Bird Tavern, just across the street from the hay. In addition to having a genius for cultivating antique roses, Mr. Gardiner would have taken a bullet for Mother and she for him. He would be with us forever.
"And a few day-maids don't break the bank," Mother said. "If you want to pinch pennies, have the consulate pay shipping for your orphan boxes."
Roger's been splitting the cost with me, but I won't have much to send this time. There isn't a scrap of wearable material to be bought.
Why not arrange a benefit performance? You may enjoy being on stage again, dear, and you still have the costumes.
The costumes? Yards of material disintegrating in an old trunk of no use to anyone, perfect for every sort of children's clothing.
Mother, you're a genius.
I ran to my bedroom and dragged the trunk from the closet. It still wore the souvenir stickers from every city I'd played in, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh. I hauled it back to the guest room, winded. I had to stop stealing Pia's cigarettes. Mother straightened up in her sewing chair as I entered.
"Oh, no, no! Don't do it, Caroline!"
I threw open the lid of the trunk and released a lovely scent of cedar, aging silk, and stage makeup. "It's brilliant, Mother."
"How can you, dear?"
We'd collected props and costumes from all over. A 19th-century silk bodice here, a silken-bone Tiffany fan there. But Mother had sewn most of the costumes I'd worn on stage, from Twelfth Night at Chapin to Victoria Regina on Broadway. I wasn't allowed to keep every ensemble, but I still had my high school costumes, and Mother often sewed a backup of the Broadway ensembles. She used the best velvets and the richest, most vivid silks and soft cottons. She finished each with mother-of-pearl buttons she made from mussel shells she'd scavenged from the beach at Southampton. A button once put on by mother was put on forever.
"Merchant of Venice," I said, pulling out a periwinkle blue velvet jacket and pants, both lined in mustard silk. "Two toddler shirts right there. What can we do with the lining?"
Mother withered.
"Underpants? Genius, dear!"
I held up a coral pink satin gown, the bodice embroidered with seed pearls.
"Twelfth night." "Are you not the least bit nostalgic?"
"Not at all, Mother. And if you resist, I'll cut them myself." She grabbed the dress from me.
"Certainly not, Caroline."
I pulled out another velvet dress the color of Amontillado sherry, a white faux ermine pelerine, and a scarlet silk robe.
"All's well that ends well," I said, holding up the dress.
Had my waist ever been that small? "We can get 6 nightshirts from the robe, 2 coats from the dress. The fur will line mittens." We worked into the night. I ripped seams and cut, the teeth of my pinking shears biting through velvets and satins.
"Any news about your friend Paul?" Mother asked.
"Not a word. Not even getting French newspapers at the office anymore." Though Mother was on a need-to-know basis about my relationship with Paul, she somehow understood how important he'd become to me. With all the developments in France, she seemed almost as concerned about him as I was.
"His wife has a dress shop?"
"A lingerie shop, actually. Called Les Jolies Choses."
"Lingerie?" Mother said, as if I'd told her Rena juggled flaming hatchets.
"Yes, Mother. Brassieres and..."
"I know what lingerie is, Caroline."
"Don't judge, Mother. Please."
"Well, even if Paul comes out of this war in one piece, there's no accounting for men."
"I just want to hear from him, Mother." Mother ripped the seam of a lavender satin lining.
"And the French. You know how that goes. Friendships with married men are quite common there, but..."
"All I want is another letter, Mother."
"You'll see. This war will blow over and he'll be knocking at your door. The Germans probably have him someplace special. He's somewhat famous, after all."
I hadn't considered that. Would the Nazis treat Paul specially, given his celebrity? By morning, we had stacked the guest bed with an exquisite assortment of children's wear. Soft coats and trousers, jumpers and hats. I lugged it all to work and left it on Pia's desk, though she was nowhere to be found. Weeks later, I had 3 generations of the LeBlanc family camped out in my office and taking turns bathing via the consulate ladies' room sink, when suddenly Roger rushed to my door and swung into my office, one hand on the door jamb, face the color of his dove-gray shirt. My stomach lurched. His bad news face. The knit brow, mouth set in a tight line. As long as he didn't close the door, I would be fine. He ran his fingers through his hair.
"Caroline?"
"Just tell me, Roger."
"I have some news."
I held on to my wooden file cabinet. "Just do it."
"It is bad, I'm afraid, see."
"Should I sit?" I said.
"I would imagine so,"
Roger said as he closed the door.
Chapter 13. Kasha. 1941. The train doors opened, and we stood as if frozen there inside the car.
"Out! Out!"
the women guards on the platform shouted. They poked and swatted us with their sticks and leather truncheons. If you've never been hit with a leather truncheon, it stings like you cannot believe. I'd never been struck with anything before, and that sting was a terrible shock.
But the dogs were the worst part, snapping and barking at us, close enough for me to feel their warm breath on my legs.
"You stink like pigs," one guard said. "Poles, of course, covered in shit."
This made me madder than anything. They give us one small bucket to use and then complain that we smell? We marched at a quick pace through Fürstenberg in that Sunday's first light, five abreast, Matka on my one side, Mrs. Michalski and baby Jagoda on the other. I glanced back and saw Zuzana and Luisa one row behind, their eyes glassy with that special kind of terror we would grow used to. Fürstenberg seemed like a medieval village out of a storybook. The buildings with sod roofs and window boxes overflowing with red petunias, windows shuttered up tight. Were the Germans still asleep in warm beds, dressing for church? Someone was awake, for the scent of toast and fresh coffee was in the air. A second-story shutter opened a crack and then closed. Those who could not keep up had a time of it, for the guards beat the slowest, and the dogs nipped at their legs. Matka and I held Mrs. Michalski to keep her from stumbling. She massaged her baby's feet, blue from the cold, kneading them like bread dough as we hurried along. They rushed us along a cobblestone road by the banks of a lake. "What a pretty lake," Luisa said behind us. "Will there be swimming?" None of us answered. What would they do with us? This was Germany, after all. As a child, a trip to Germany had always been entertaining, as long as one did not have to stay too long. With most things, you knew what to expect. Like when you went to the circus for the first time, you had some idea. Not with this. Soon, we saw an enormous brick building at the end of the road. It was only September, but the trees turned early that far north, orange and flame red among the pines. Even the salvia planted along the foundation of that brick building was Nazi red. As we marched closer, German patriotic music blared in the distance, and the smell of cooking potatoes filled the air, which sent my stomach growling. "It's a Kz," the woman behind me said to no one in particular. "Konzentrationsschlager." I'd never heard that word, nor did I know what a concentration camp was. But the sound of the word sent ice water down my spine. We approached the high, smooth walls that surrounded the camp and stepped through green metal gates to an open plaza surrounded by low wooden buildings. Even through the music, I could hear the wire atop the wall buzz with high voltage. The wide road cut through the middle of camp, officially called Lagerstrasse, or Camp Road, but which we soon came to call Beauty Road. That road really was beautiful. It started at the vast cobblestone plaza known as the Platz and ran straight back through camp, covered in black shiny sand and chunks of black slag that glinted in the sun. A honey-sweet scent caught my nose and drew my attention to the trees, which lined the road as far as the eye could see. Linden trees. What a comfort it was to see this, the favorite tree of the Virgin Mary. The linden is revered in Poland, and it's bad luck to cut one down. In front of each block was planted a cheerful little garden of flowers, and at each block window hung a wooden flower box planted with geraniums. How bad could such a neatly kept place be? Oddest of all, an ornate silver cage stood at the beginning of Beauty Road, filled with exotic animals, yellow-winged parrots, two brown spider monkeys who swung about the cage playing like children, and a peacock with an emerald-green head who fanned out his feathers. The peacock shrieked, and a shiver went through me. Matka gathered us close as we took it all in. Across the plots, rows of women in striped dresses stood at attention, five to a row, not one looking in our direction. A female guard pulled a revolver from the holster at her hip and asked the guard next to her a question about it. Matka spied the gun and quickly looked away. A girl in a striped dress passed near me.
"Polish?"
she said, her voice almost drowned out by the music. "Yes," I said, "all of us." The spider monkey stopped playing and watched us, fingers fisted around the cage bars.
"They will take any food you have, so eat it up quickly," she said, and walked away to line up. "Give us everything you have. You won't need it," said an older woman passing by, her hand out as she walked the length of the column.
We clutched our coats around us tighter. Why would we give up the few things we had? I glanced at Matka. She reached out, and her hand trembled as she squeezed mine. I wanted only a bed for sleep and something to end my terrible thirst. The guards herded us into the utility block, two big open rooms with low ceilings and the shower room off to one side. A tall blonde guard we later learned was named Binz stood at the door, as frantic and exercised as Hitler himself.
"Hurry! Hurry!" she cried as she stung my bottom with her crop.
I came to a desk, and a woman sitting behind it in a striped dress took down my name. In German, she told me to empty my pockets, and she dumped the few possessions I had. The handkerchief, my watch, some aspirin, the last vestiges of normal life, into a yellow envelope, and placed it with the others in a file box. Next, I was ordered to strip, while a prisoner guard watched.
"Move along," she said once I was naked.
I saw Matka behind me, stopped next at the table. They wanted her ring, but she was having trouble twisting it off of her finger.
"Her finger is swollen," said the woman doctor standing nearby, tall and blonde in her white doctor's smock.
Binz lifted Matka's hand, spat on the ring, and tried to work it off. Matka turned her head.
"Try petroleum jelly," the woman doctor said.
Binz spat on the ring again and finally twisted it off. The woman behind the desk dropped it into a yellow envelope and placed it in the file box. Matka's ring was gone. How could they just take a person's things with no feeling at all? I saw Janina Grabowski far ahead of me in line, wrestling with a guard and crying out. She was undergoing the hairdresser's exam. A second guard came to assist the first and held Janina by the shoulders.
"Stop! No! Please!"
she said as they tried to cut her hair off. A guard pushed me along and I lost Matka, who was swallowed up in the crush of women. I tried to cover my nakedness as a prisoner with a green triangle on the shoulder of her striped jacket pushed me to a stool. Once I felt a toothpick touch my scalp, I knew I was about to follow Janina's fate, and my heart tried to escape my chest. It thumped so. The scissors were cold against the back of my neck, and the woman swore in German as she hacked through my braid. Was I to blame for my thick hair? She threw the braid onto a pile of hair so high it reached the windowsill, and then, as if in payment for making her work harder, shaved my head roughly. I shook all over as every click of the trimmer sent hunks of hair sliding down my bare shoulders. She pushed me off the stool, and I felt my head. Smooth, with just tufts of hair here and there. Thank God Pietrik wasn't there to see that. How cold it was without hair. A prisoner with a purple triangle, a Bible girl, I later learned, pushed me back onto a table used to examine gynecological parts. She held my legs apart while a second prisoner shaved me with a straight razor, leaving me cut and scraped. When that was finished, they sent me onto the woman doctor, who said,
"On the table,"
and took a cold silver instrument, put it in me, and opened me up, all without even toweling it off. She spread me out for all the world to see,
and jabbed her rubber-gloved fingers inside me and felt around. She was not at all horrified by her job and might just as well have been washing a dish. She acted with no regard for the fact that I was young and she was violating me in a way that could never be undone. I had little time to mourn my lost virginity, for guards lined us up naked, five across, in the shower room. A shower attendant in white coveralls hit the women in front of us with a truncheon, leaving red welts on their backsides as they ran to the showerheads. I stayed near Mrs. Mikelski and braced for the sting of the rubber. She held baby Yagoda close to her, shivering so badly it was as if cold water were already running over her. A prisoner with a green badge on her sleeve came to Mrs. Mikelski, put two hands around the baby's skinny naked body, and pulled. Mrs. Mikelski held Yagoda tight. "Give it to me," the prisoner guard said. Mrs. Mikelski only held tighter. "She's a good baby," I said to the guard. The guard pulled harder at the child. Would they tear her in two? "It can't be helped," the guard said. "Don't make a scene." The baby cried out, which caught the attention of the nasty head wardress, Dorothea Binz, who came almost at a run from the front of the building, a second guard close behind. The name Dorothea means God's gift, and a name could not have been more wrong for a person. Binz came to a stop next to Mrs. Mikelski and pointed her leather crop at little blonde Yagoda.
"Is the father German?"
Mrs. Mikelski glanced at me, her brow creased. "No, Polish," she said.
"Just take it," Binz said with a wave of her crop.
The guard who had come with Binz held Mrs. Mikelski from behind while the first guard pried Yagoda from her mother's arms. "I made a mistake," Mrs. Mikelski said. "Yes, actually the father is German," she glanced at me. "From Berlin," I said. "A real patriot." The green badge held naked Yagoda to her shoulder and looked at Binz.
"Just take it," Binz said with a jerk of her head.
The guard hiked the baby higher on her shoulder and walked back through the incoming crowd. Mrs. Mikelski crumpled to the floor like a burning piece of paper as she watched her baby be taken away.
"No, please. Where are you taking her?"
Binz poked her crop into Mrs. Mikelski's ribs and pushed her toward the showers. I folded my arms across my naked chest and stepped closer to Binz. "That child will die without her mother," I said. Binz turned to me, her expression bringing to mind a bubbling teapot. "There is no greater cruelty," I said. Binz raised her crop to me.
"You Poles."
I closed my eyes, bracing myself, waiting for the sting of the leather. Where would the blows land? Suddenly, I felt arms slide around me. Matka, her naked body smooth on mine.
"Please, Madame Wardress," she said in her prettiest German. "She is out of her head to speak to you this way. How sorry we are."
Was it my mother's German that caused Binz to take a step back? Her gentle way?
"You tell her to keep her mouth shut,"
Binz said, shaking her crop in my direction. She retreated through the crowd. The guards shoved me dazed into a shower, my tears for poor Mrs. Mikelski mixing with the sting of cold shower water. They released us from quarantine 2 weeks later, with only our uniform shift and blouse, enormous wooden clogs, a toothbrush, a thin jacket, gray bloomers, a tin bowl and spoon, and a piece of soap we were told had to last 2 months.
2 months?
Surely we'd be home by then. Our new home, Block 32, was much larger than the quarantine block. Women, some in their uniform gray shirts and striped dresses,
some naked from the shower, ran about dressing, squaring up their straw mattresses, and tucking in their blue and white checked sheets. There was a small washroom in the block with three shower heads and three long sinks, each filled by means of a spout. Women sat with no modesty atop a platform drilled with holes to send nature's offerings to the putrid ground below. The block smelled like a chicken coop, rotten beets, and 500 unwashed feet. All of the girls in the block spoke Polish, and most wore the red triangle of political prisoners. If there was any good thing about the camp, it was that so many of the prisoners were Polish, almost half, most there, like us, for what the Nazis called political crimes. After Poles, the next largest group was German women, arrested for violating one of Hitler's many rules or for criminal activities such as murder or theft.
"Square your bed!" shouted Rosa, the block over, a German woman with sleepy eyes.
She was from Berlin and not much older than my mother. Later I learned she'd been arrested for sticking her tongue out at a German officer.
"Attend your mess kit!"
We quickly learned that survival at Ravensbrück revolved around one's tin bowl, cup, and spoon, and the ability to safeguard them. If one looked away for a moment, they might disappear, never to return. As a result, we kept our kits tucked in the chests of our uniforms, or if one was lucky enough to acquire a piece of twine or string, made that into a belt and wore them strung on it at the waist. Luisa and Matka chose a top bunk, what the prisoners called the coconut palms, since it was high up. It was very close to the ceiling, so they could barely sit up, and in the winter icicles hung from above it, but it was more private up there. Susanna and I slept just opposite. I had to push down my jealousy at Luisa sleeping with my mother. I got Susanna, who shifted all night in her sleep, mumbling doctor talk. When she woke me up, I would spend the night fretting in the darkness, paralyzed with guilty thoughts. How could I have been so reckless to have gotten us all sent to this terrible place? To make things worse, the block was never quiet, always filled with the sounds of shrill voices of women tortured by nightmares or the itch of lice, night shift workers returning home, sleepless women exchanging recipes, and calls for a basin for the sick who could not get to the washroom in time. I did find moments to be alone with Matka, though. That night, I crawled into the bunk with her before dinner.
"I am so sorry I got you here, Matka. If you hadn't brought that sandwich, if I hadn't..."
"Don't think that way," she said. "In here, you have to concentrate all you have on being smarter than the Germans. I'm glad I'm here with you girls. This will all be fine." She kissed my forehead.
"But your ring, I hate them for taking it."
"It's just a thing, Kasia. Don't waste your energy on the hate. That will kill you sure as anything. Focus on keeping your strength. You're resourceful. Find a way to outsmart them." Blokova Rosa strode in. She had a kind face but did not smile as she made announcements.
"Work call is at 8 a.m. Those without work assignments, report to the labor office next to the block where you were processed. That is where you will pick up your badge or number."
"She speaks only in German," I whispered to Matka. "What about the girls who don't understand?"
"Say a prayer of thanks for Herr Speck's German class. It may save your life." She was right. I was lucky I spoke German, since all announcements were made in that language, no exceptions. The non-German speakers had a terrible disadvantage, since ignorance was no excuse for disregarding rules. The next morning, the siren startled us awake. I just dozed off, dreaming about swimming with Pietrik in Lublin, when the lights in our block came on at 3:30 a.m. The worst part was that siren, a screech so loud and piercing, it was as if it were from the bowels of hell. With this siren, Rosa and her Stubova assistants came through the rows of beds. One Stubova banged on a tin pan, and one poked at sleepers with the leg of a stool, and Rosa splashed ladles of water from a bucket onto sleeping women's faces.
"Get up! Hurry! Everyone up!" they called.
This was a special kind of torture. Matka, Zuzanna, Luisa, and I made our way to the dining hall, the long room next to our sleeping quarters, and squeezed onto a bench at the end. Breakfast was the same as it had been in quarantine. Lukewarm yellowish soup that was more like turnip water and a small piece of bread that tasted like sawdust. The soup hit my stomach and almost came back up. Rosa read a list of new assignments. Matka was assigned to the bookbindery, one of the highly sought-after inside positions. It was much harder to work a prisoner to death when she was sitting at a desk. Luisa became an assistant to the Bible girls, who processed Angora rabbit fur. The Angora rabbits lived at the far end of the camp in specially heated cages and were fed tender lettuce from the commandant's greenhouse. Their fur was periodically shaved and sent to the tailor's workshop, a massive complex of 8 interconnected warehouses where prisoners assembled German army uniforms. Zuzanna, who did not reveal she was a medical doctor, ended up sorting the booty piles, the mounds of Hitler's stolen plunder that came by train. I was assigned as an available, a good and bad thing. Good since we lined up every day and, if not chosen to work, had that day to lie in the bunk. But bad since, if chosen, we were assigned some of the worst jobs, like latrine cleaner or road crew worker. Being assigned to the road crew and used like an animal to pull a heavy concrete roller could kill a person in one day. Our first Christmas at Ravensbrück was especially bad, for many of us had been certain we'd be home by then. Matka, Zuzanna, Luisa, and I had only been there for 3 months, but it felt like 3 years. We had received a few letters from Papa by then. They were written in German, per regulations, and mostly struck through with black marker, leaving only a few words and his last line, "Your loving Papa." We wrote letters, too, on single-paged camp stationery, limited by the censors to writing about the weather and vague, positive thoughts. As the days grew shorter, Zuzanna warned us to keep our spirits up, for sadness was often a more potent killer than disease. Some just gave up, stopped eating, and died. Christmas morning started with a pane of glass shattering in the cold. The air rushed in, waking us all. Did this devil wind prying us from our beds on Christ's Day mean bad things for us? Every prisoner in camp shuffled out onto the Platz for Appell, a massive group roll call. We then lined up 10 abreast in the darkness next to the Revere. The only sound, the stomping of hundreds of clogs echoing around the Platz as we tried to ward off the cold. How I wished for a warm coat. The searchlights arced overhead. Surely Appell would be short and uneventful because of Christmas. Didn't Germans celebrate Christ's birth? Maybe Binz would take Christmas off. I tried not to look at the pile of bodies, stacked like firewood next to the linen shop, covered in a light dusting of snow. There the bodies waited for the man from town with his morgue car to come and slide each into one of his paper bags with frilly ends and drive them off. A young guard in training named Irma Greze, Binz's star protégé, hurried down the rows, counting us and marking numbers down on her clipboard. She stopped now and then to enjoy a cigarette, standing there wrapped in her thick black coat. While Greze and Binz were like truant teenaged best friends, both blonde and beautiful, there was no mistaking one for the other. Binz was tall, with slightly coarser features, and wore her hair in an Olympia roll, teased and rolled up from her forehead. Greze was petite and movie star pretty, with almond-shaped blue eyes and naturally pink lips. Under her uniform cap, she wore her hair pulled back into 2 shining ringlets, like rolls of golden coins, one down each side of her neck, Unfortunately for us, Irma had no talent for numbers. Often her hasty head counts failed to match Binz's, leading to 3- and 4-hour appels. The sun breached the horizon, sending golden rays over the plots.